domino, on the spot if you black the hat. Domino, domino, on the spot if you black the hat. As you may know, I started this podcast because I was tired of being the only black male or one of the few black people at my organizations. This can be crazy. I was constantly called upon to speak for the black experience or expected to do the emotional labor after blatantly racist things occurred. This is heavy, and it left me feeling fragile, unseen, unappreciated, and definitely in need of a change. I began to ask my friends if they've ever experienced being the only one or one of the few people of color at their jobs and the impact it had upon them. We discussed what it felt like to experience microaggressions and not have a friend or ally to lean on. Balancing the thin line between needing your coins and not being tokenized is never easy. But guess what? You have us now, and we will always have your back. The Black Work Experience Podcast explores the intersection between race, class, and privilege in America and in the workforce. We tell the stories of those who paved and are currently paving the way. As people of color gain more institutional, political, and economic power, we often find ourselves surrounded by people who do not look like us, talk like us, or even think like us. This podcast discusses what it's like to walk in the shoes of those who feel alone. I fully recognize that not all black people think alike. The stories we share on this podcast may seem foreign to you and your experience, but rest assured, bucko, a lot of black people experience microaggressions daily, and we need an outlet. This is your outlet. You all are not alone, and guess what? We got your back. This podcast is for all people, but we focus heavily on black people. I want you to know that you're not the only one experiencing microaggressions, otherness, and potential loneliness at work. If you identify with majority culture, listen to this podcast. Think about how you can help your black colleagues when your coworker talks over them, when your coworker runs to the manager instead of having a difficult conversation with that black person, or calls them intimidating or hostile. We need you all in this work. We need everyone in this work. But guess what time it is? All right, you guessed it. It's mail time. Today, our story comes from Andrea. I'm so tired of my job. I had to quit. Even after George Floyd, Amy Cooper, and Ahmaud Arbery, I am still getting hell about speaking up on black issues. I was told I make the white women uncomfortable and I should tone it down. This literally sent me into shakes. I've had to think about everything before I say it, consciously think about my body language, attire, and hair to fit into this mold of what this organization desires. I submitted my resignation today, and to think, they gave us Juneteenth off to pacify us, but they really do not respect their black employees. I hate it here. Signed, black, proud, and sick of this shit. Andrea, that is a word from on high. And I think about all the people that this is happening to who are at organizations, all the black women specifically who are on the front lines and have to show up after being on the front lines and internalizing all of that. My hat goes off to you. It really makes me think about this meme that's going across social media now. And it says, if racists are kneeling on necks in broad daylight, imagine what they are doing in HR departments, classrooms, and medical offices across the country. We know it's bigger than just the police. Y'all, that right there is a word. Andrea has to tone down herself just to make white women feel comfortable. This whole entire society, this system is built on white fragility and the need to protect white women. There are countless stories of white women pushing people out of organizations, making sure they don't get promotions. Like, we have to deal with this. Andrea, I'm so sorry that you are experiencing it. And once you get your new job, if you already have it, just write in to us so we can know and inform the listeners of the podcast, because I know they'll be concerned about you. And for all of you who have your own mail time stories, please get it into us. We're always accepting them. I am pilfering through them. You can send it to us on our Twitter at BWEP
podcast. You can send it to us on our Instagram and our DMs at BWEPpod, or you can send it the old-fashioned way right on Gmail, blackworkexperiencepodcast@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. And thank you all for sending them in, because like they really tell the story that we can't tell as well as you. Thank you again.
Welcome to the Black Work Experience Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Stevens, and I am joined by my special co-host and beautiful wife, Sharanda Stevens. This episode is a little different. As you all know, our country has been engulfed in protests for over 2 weeks following the high-profile murders of Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and George Floyd. Just this past Friday, Rashard Brooks in Atlanta was added to the list as he was murdered by police after falling asleep in the drive-thru and running away.
We've seen a lot of commentary, videos, and discussions about racism and how it impacts our everyday lives. Robert and I talk about this a lot in our family, and we're interested in hearing how other families, particularly interracial ones, are approaching this. To that end, we've invited Mikhail and Autumn Campbell to the podcast to discuss how we're navigating this difficult time.
Mikhail and Autumn, thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, thank y'all for having us.
Yeah, we're happy to be here.
Don't mention it. Well, as always, you know, we always start the podcast off like this. Tell us about yourself. Who are you? Where are you from? How did you meet? And what do you do now?
Oh, yeah. Well, I will go first. My name is Mikhail Campbell. I was born and raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and often say that I was able to experience and observe what Black excellence is and meant at a very early age. I currently work for an organization called Teach for America, where I am able to support principals and other people along their identity journey, knowing that that's a major factor in educational equity.
And my name is Autumn Campbell. I'm from Washington State, moved to Dallas to be a core member of Teach for America, where I met Mikhail, and was a teacher a couple years, then a high school counselor. I now am a financial planner and do individual comprehensive financial planning for families that are looking to make good choices with the resources they have.
Wow, well, we have some pretty advanced individuals on the podcast today. I'm honored to have you all. I know you all spoke a little bit about your meeting in Dallas, but tell us a little bit, like, how did you meet exactly?
Oh, gosh. Well, we often tell people that, so we met through a program where we were both teaching together, just through a normal training, but it was a classic young people meet thing. I was stressed and was like, hey, let's go out with a group of friends to go dancing and have a good time, and Autumn also was a part of that group who was excited, and then Friday came along, and nobody showed up except us two, and that kind of allowed us to get time to kind of get to know each other one more. Have more in-depth conversations, and that just kind of started the spark of it all.
Wow, that's amazing. I guess you can say that was pretty fortuitous.
It certainly was. I remember knowing of Mikhail as the very gregarious person he is, and getting to have one-on-one conversations with him, learning about his background, how he thinks about the world, and what he's overcome throughout his life. Was something that I didn't get the privilege of knowing until having those one-off conversations. And fast forward several years, we're married and
still having those conversations.
Still having them, yeah.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. How has your racial identities impacted your marriage, career, and your life?
Oh, gosh. Do you want to go first or do you want me to go?
Sure, I'll go. Growing up, I would have said it didn't, or not to my knowledge. I mean, I knew I was white, but I didn't get reminded that I was white at all. I grew up in a small town of about 10,000 people at the time, and nearly everyone was white, at least 90%+ of people. So I didn't identify in that way and wasn't reminded of it much. And also being female, half the people I went to school with were female, so I didn't, and a lot of my teachers were. So I wasn't really reminded of some of my demographics in the way that now, being in an interracial marriage, having been a part of Teach for America, also looking to do equity work in different ways within the financial planning world, I'm very reminded of that, especially with the people and the voices that I surround myself with.
I think for me, race has always been top of mind for me. I think it took some years before my identity as a black male was like solely my identity, right? In America, it's really hard to differentiate being socialized as either of those. I grew up also the oldest of multiple siblings. So with all the responsibilities that come, I also grew up to the house of a single mother, right? So there was a lot of things that I think very early on I was asked and kind of forced to be an adult, which I think that how that impacts and shows up in my life later, right, was that there was a lot of childhood-like things that I just never really experienced because of that growing up quickly piece. Also living in Oklahoma and growing up black also meant something, and I think always will mean something. The black population in Oklahoma itself is relatively small, although Tulsa and Oklahoma City, where the cities are, it's a little bit larger. But how that's often impacted my life is I've always been seen as the exception. And I think for years there was a lot of internalized oppression about why I love that identity, right? I can remember multiple memories of childhood and youth of people who didn't necessarily like black people, but they had no problem with Michael, right? And something about that as an adolescent, someone seeking community, it felt really good. And then as I've gotten older, and obviously as I've matured in my identity development of understanding what that is, it's not accepting me as an individual. It's seeing me as different than my people, which is not true, right? I am just as black as anyone else, but that wasn't the narrative that I was really taught or told as a kid or youth, just growing up around lots of white people. How that shows up today, though, in the workplace, I think it shows up in every way, right? And when I want to share direct, clear feedback, I have to watch my tone. Not because I'm going to have a wrong tone, but because I know that as a black male, my passion can easily be interpreted as a threat, right?
Oh, for
I know
sure.
that. I know that the people that I want to talk to and build relationships with for work, if they don't know me beforehand, there is a lot of initial relationship building that I have to do because they may be like, who is this black dude coming to talk to my school, right? Like, those things I think will always be a part of my experience.
Michael, you know, I think that you're hitting upon something that's so real in terms with the way we have to navigate the world. The thought processes that we have to have before we even open our mouth to make sure that our presence doesn't alarm individuals, and we have to do things to disarm them actually just so that we can get our job done. I think that is so real. You and Autumn have, you know, just full disclosure, we're all friends on Facebook, and so we see, I participate and see a lot of the conversations that you all are having. And we touched upon this during the intro, just like the place we are in this country right now as it relates to just like high-profile killings of individuals, particularly black people and black women and black men by police. So, you know, how are you all discussing the high-profile deaths of Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, and many others?
Yeah, the real answer is it depends on the day, right? Just being real transparent. These hit home, and I'm tired of experiencing the trauma of seeing my people murdered on my timeline, right? Like, so some days that means that Autumn will be like, Michael, I'm processing this, need to talk. And I'll be like, hey, not today. Today I need self-care. I'm going to go sit on our patio and spend some time with myself. And there's days like that where we are not discussing. She is engaging, but I'm not. And that's important. But also for us, it's the talking about it to the people that matter. So we have a niece who, she stayed with us for the last month, kind of when COVID hit big. It just worked out really well. She's 15, a black girl. And it hit home for us, just another moment of when we were kind of talking with her and joshing her because she, you know, she is also in an interracial relationship. And so, you know, my friends, other fifth graders, make comments that I only like white boys. And she goes, that's not true. And through more and more talking in the conversation, I go, well, you know, what is the fear or what is the thing with, you know, dating other black boys, you know, at this age? And she just honestly goes, I think I would lose them to violence. Like, here's a child that's 15 that's processing her experience, and enough of this has happened that she believes that loving someone that's a black male is a risk of losing them in a way that is not true for any other demographic. And sitting with things like that and those type of conversations, like, that's what our household has really been a lot of doing is talking about that and really understanding how that these things that we see start to impact the day-to-day experiences of people we love.
Just to add to what Michael shared, we're both on our own journeys of our identity and understanding of what's going on in the world. So there are some things that I engage with because I have a lot of learning to do as someone who didn't even understand the depth of racial identities and how that plays out in the experiences we have in the world until my 20s. And so I will watch different films or videos and read different books that Michael doesn't need to read or watch to have that growth himself. And I also do that to have that as a personal reference to do my self-work, but also as a reference to other people who have known me through my life. Many times it's white people who trust me as someone who they would like to hear the thoughts from or share their own grapplings with. And I consider it to be more of equipping myself to have productive conversations with people to help guide them towards considering things they have not personally experienced or to better understand and empathize with things that people go through. I've seen on Facebook and different people's postings about how this is perpetuated by white people and or white women and how I try to do a lot of self-thinking of how am I being complicit and benefiting from things at play and how am I also helping other people, myself and other people, understand what's at play and advocating for people, especially when they're not in the spaces and the rooms that I'm in.
Yeah, thank you. I would love to talk more. I think you just hit on something that was really interesting about the difficult conversations and during your own learning, how you had to have those conversations. And would love to hear more about the conversations you've had to have with your families and people that are close to you about racism as a result of your marriage or the things that you've been seeing on social media.
And when we talk about something such as politicians or different policies, that usually has not been very productive in my experience. However, when I mention, even recently I mentioned to a family member, hey, you're going to have grandchildren that are mixed race that will be seen as black. I would like you to engage with these resources because I'd like to have conversations with you about this. So that if and when you experience things that are confusing you, we can talk through them and we can help have those teachable moments as a team with these children that we're going to be raising in our family. Because it's not just Michael and I that will be influencing those children. So I'd like my family to be more equipped to identify those things and to address them in a positive light as an example to the children, and also to hopefully help others know better ways to engage and to uplift our families.
Yeah. And I think those are the nicer things that we've been able to do in those matter, like where we see growth as a real option. And like boundaries are a real thing for us. My black kids will be traumatized in this world for lots of things. The last thing that I want them to do is when they go to cousin's house or when they go to XY, whoever's house, they're also experiencing that, right? That's not something that I believe I want my child to be a part of. And that is a different conversation, and those are more difficult with some family members about how they show up, knowing that because of how you show up, you will never spend time alone with my kid.
Wow.
Yeah, I've never had to, think about that, Sharonda and I, because, we're not in an interracial marriage, and the vast majority of our family members, almost all of them, identify as black. It just makes me think about the extra work. We all do
additional labor, right? Emotional labor.
Yep.
I think specifically as Black people, like the emotional labor of having to smile when we really want to yell, right? Or all of those different things. Autumn, you mentioned something that made me think about this because I'm prone to having real conversations. And, Michael, I don't think I'm as good as you with thinking about how to disarm people. So sometimes I just tell white people, particularly white women, that, like, you are a problem, right? Like, the things that you're doing is problematic. Have you ever, and Autumn, this question is particularly for you, like, has that ever been said to you? And like, how, I guess I'm trying to understand from the other side of it, how could one feel, you know, like when you do things or when people do things that are like problematic and like people like generally like call individuals out on them. I'm thinking about like the Karen situations, particularly Amy Cooper and how she was able to weaponize her whiteness as a woman, you know, to really try to get that gentleman, Chris Cooper, I think, in trouble, right? And like, did you all have those conversations? How did that impact you all? Did you talk about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've had things like that specifically happen to where we've had to have more serious conversations before issues arose. So a real example is when we were early on in dating, we live in Texas, we were going for a walk from our apartment to a local restaurant. We're being playful. And I think I tickled you or something, babe. And Autumn screams. Because I tickled her, and in my face, and the moment she saw how I reacted to her screaming in the middle of a street while we are in public and people are around, was a really hard moment for us. And just the nuance of what that means and how I emotionally responded, and then she had her whole range of emotions also.
Yeah, that was one of the first insights I had to your lived experience and what that could mean, despite my intent, right? Mm-hmm. And layers behind that. I have seen in the workplace, just in general, I've had the opportunity to learn from other people how much white dominant culture just permeates the workplace to the point where I can't see it very well. It's how I've always grown up. It's my norm. It's the water I've always swam in and have been accepted in as well. And people don't identify me any differently by looking at me. Through engaging with people of color and women of color, I've been able to understand how the norms that I've upheld as the way to be or the right way are not true. They're not better. Mm-hmm. They're more comfortable for me, perhaps. And honestly, that's how I've been able to grow and then advocate for people and different demographics when I'm in spaces because of the learning that I've had and the time people have taken out to help me see my blind spots. Because I don't know that I would have seen them otherwise without someone helping me understand how that's just, in a fair and just world, we would have the same experiences, but that's why we're all talking together, because we're not. And sometimes it's very comfortable to believe that, to just focus on the fair and just world we all want, so we all agree. And unfortunately, we're not there at this point, so we've got to each work for that for all of us, and I try to do that in the ways that I've been privileged to have communication with different people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Michael, I was reminded of a situation we had a while ago. When I was pregnant, actually, we were living in Dallas, and we were walking down the street, and there was a guy coming toward us with a dog, and we were on the right side. He was on the left side, the same street, and he just let his dog, like, come up really, really close to me as we were passing. And my husband got so upset and, like, started yelling at the guy, like, move your dog. You know, like, I was nervous and scared. It was a huge dog. And I, like, immediately got mad at him, at my husband, for standing up for me because I was afraid of, like, what would happen to him if they got into it. And instead of, like, caring about my safety and caring about if this dog jumped on me, I got mad at him because I was afraid. And I didn't want anything to happen to him. So I'm like, it's okay. It's okay. Don't worry about it. Like, it's fine. And he was so upset. But, like, that's the world that we live in. It's like, I'm afraid that if you stand up for me and say something to this white man coming down the street with this dog, like, anything could happen. And that just, I remember that story, and it was really difficult for us to have that conversation of, like,
yeah,
really, Sharanda? Like, you care more about that? I'm like, but I love you, and I don't want anything to happen to you. And it was hard, really hard.
I mean, just a social norm, we navigate that so much. I mean, just when we want to go out and we want to grab a drink, or we want to go to a hookah lounge or whatever, it's always the understanding that if we are driving home later, or if we go to walk to the next bar, if we do whatever, am I going to be perceived as more threatening or more of a reason to give a police officer to think something more because my eyes are red or because my speech is slurred, right? But I'm not driving. Like, all those things should be acceptable. And the idea that they are, I just am not at a place yet. And so to affirm your story, I'm like, there's just a lot of those moments that happen.
Yeah.
You know, you just said something that really connected a question that I think a lot of people are thinking about. And you mentioned, like, your eyes being red. And is that a reason for a police officer to stop you? And I want to just think through and really ask you all, how have you all navigated a conversation around police brutality? And I ask that because we know, when we think about the inception of police, right, police were created back in the 1700s to really control black bodies, individuals who were enslaved, right? Like, that's the creation of police. So, and I know that systemically and, like, historically, like, white people and black people have had different perceptions of the role police play in our communities. So how have you all discussed, like, police brutality and, like, how you see police operating in like, society?
Yeah. For me, it's something really personal here in Tulsa. Given our history of race relations and the Tulsa Race Massacre, given Terrence Crutcher was in this city on a street that I have walked down dozens of times, the work of understanding how police brutality plays out and understanding the systemic pressures of police brutality is really important, particularly this piece of the system versus the individuals. So I've been a part of a number of community and police initiatives. And, if you have my timeline, I'll probably have 30 to 40 different officers that I, like, count as, like, social media friends, right? They're Facebook friends. That their individual experience and who they are as police officers, when I am often talking about brutality, it's not at the individual layer. It's the idea that as an officer, if you feel threatened, whatever officer that is, they are able to use a level of force that other people can't, and understanding why that's dangerous. And cool, if you are a great officer and you have great emotional intelligence and you always stay calm and you always de-escalate, then great, I'm not talking to you. But that's not the system, right? Not every officer is that officer. And what I don't want to do is, my humanity and my life should not depend on which individual officer that I'm getting to interact with, because I have no choice in that.
Correct.
And really making sure that, like, people understand how the system works, and it's less about the cops that play basketball and the cops that show up to the barbecue. Those are all nice gestures of their humanity and my humanity, but that's not what we're talking about in these moments. And just getting that violence is violence. Like, there's no – you can believe it is legal violence, but we have to understand that we're still talking about violence, right? When people are protesting and being shot with rubber bullets or being gassed, right? It may be to break up protest. I'm not saying it's not, but it's still violence. And I think I've really struggled, honestly, if I'm being honest with y'all, with the narrative around protests currently happening, that they should be nonviolent and should be nonviolent. And the nature of nonviolent means an absence of violence. But what I keep hearing people want to say is, Black folks need to show up and be peaceful and protest, but if cops shoot at you, or if cops knock you down, or if cops push a 75-year-old man over, whoops, they just do their jobs and accidents happen. Right? That's not a peaceful protest. That is violence against citizens. And I think, like, that's something I'm really trying to sit within this moment, that when people look so positively around the civil rights era and all the good work that happened, I'm like, yes, my ancestors did amazing work. And their strategy was having people feel pity upon seeing on the news at 7 o'clock every night, black people being hosed, black people being attacked by dogs, all this violence happening to us, to then that level of violence, only then will we get the emotions of white people to be like, oh, maybe this isn't right. Right? And I think I really struggle with that, honestly, man.
No, that's real. That's real. I think that, you know, as someone who's been out on the front lines and seen and experienced both tear gas, you know, chemical agents, shot with rubber bullets, you know, I've seen it. And asking individuals in this day and age to return, like, escalating like levels of violence with nonviolence, you know, it's, you know, that's cumbersome, that's hard, but I think that you're right. I would love to hear Autumn, how you address this and what your thoughts are on it as well.
Yeah, it's hard. As Michael said, there's an institutional level and then there's the individual level. We have many close friends, and some of my closest friends in life are married to police officers and people associated in that community. And what has been confusing to me as I've become more involved with different black people and in communities that are with people of color, I've seen things such as cops, what I perceive to be as kind of hanging out to wait until something happens, or loitering. I don't know if that's the right word, but just kind of waiting. And I remember asking Michael one time when we were visiting some family, what are they doing over there? And his family didn't pay no mind. It was a normal thing. But I thought, well, what are they doing though? This is just a residential street, and they're kind of just like watching. And he goes, oh, they do that. That was one of my first experiences. And I thought, wait, the cops I've been around in the past don't do that. And I've also seen things that are troubling where there's so many layers, right? Socioeconomic status. And we've seen how the black community has been, has not gotten fair treatment on access to so many different areas of wealth building. And so there are different things that come through living in lower socioeconomic communities. And I've seen a lot of people that I grew up near talking about black-on-black crime, and that's so hard to see because there's so many layers to it, and there's so much focus on that when, if we just look at the systemic numbers, there's a disproportional amount of people being killed and being treated improperly based on really the color of their skin. That's not what people say. And I'll end with one other thing that I've been grappling with, and that's, I went to a conference called QUADA, African American Association of Financial Advisors, where I had the opportunity to be one of the few white people in that space. And Jane Elliott, the woman who did the research on the blue-eyed, brown-eyed children, was able to speak there. And she said, please stand up if you've ever felt like you've been treated differently based on your race. Nearly everyone in the room proceeds to stand up. She says, please stay standing if you want to see white people hurt the way that they have hurt you. Everyone proceeds to sit down. And that gave me shivers, because I think there's this idea that, I wonder if there's this fear that if white people lose power, then black people are going to do to them what they've done to others. And I haven't necessarily heard people say that, but I think that there's this underlying fear of anger begets anger. And while I think there's frustration and certainly negative emotion and sadness and sorrow that comes from that, I don't hear any black people in my personal experience saying those things ever. I hear them being frustrated. I hear them talking about white privilege. I hear them talking about blindness and willful ignorance, but not that I want you to have that same pain that we've gone through. It's more so, we want to be treated as equals. We want to be treated with dignity. We want to be held accountable if we are choosing wrong things, but not two, three, four, five, six times the rate of white people who do those same things. And so that's where I try to have those conversations with people, that it's not that individuals are flawless, right? You hear those stories about George Floyd going around, he was not a saint. And that's not the point that we're making. That's irrespective of that. Nothing he did deserved what happened to him.
Yeah,
exactly. Autumn, you said something that really resonated, and I think it's like, oh, my goodness. You mentioned that black people don't want revenge. They want equality. And there's a meme that goes around social media every so often that says, I think that the consensus is, what would it be like if black people wanted revenge when we only want equality, right? And I think that's super dope. And lastly, you spoke about, like, oh, Mikhail, you seen that meme yourself?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And lastly, you spoke about something that resonated as well, like the systemic nature of this, right? Because a lot of times people don't understand, because I'm on the front lines calling for, like, defunding the police and things of that sort, right? And people don't understand that these are not individual actions that we're talking about of individual officers. These are systemic things that we're calling to bear. And when you talk about that police officer who was sitting, like, waiting for something to happen, it made me think about AOC, her answer, because they asked her very, very recently, I think last night or yesterday, what would defunding the police look like, right? And she said it very, very, like, she spoke to it very poignantly. She said it looks like a suburb where affluent white communities already live in a world where they choose to fund youth, health, housing, and et cetera, more than they fund police. These communities have lower crime rates, not because they have more police, but because they have more resources to support a healthy society in a way that reduces crime. When a teenager or preteen does something harmful in a suburb, and I say teen because this is often where the lifelong carceral cycles begin for black and brown communities, white communities bend over backwards to find alternatives to incarceration for their loved ones to protect their future. Think about Dylan Roof. That comes to mind, right? I mean, not Dylan Roof. The gentleman in Stanford who raped the lady.
Oh, yeah.
And the judge gave him 3 months. Just gave him 3 months because he had a bright future ahead of him, right? And she said, why don't we treat black and brown people the same way? Why doesn't the criminal system care about black teens' futures the way they care for white teens' futures? And why doesn't the news use black people's graduation or family photos in stories the way they do when they cover white people? Example given, Brock Turner, that was his name, who committed hateful crimes. Affluent white suburbs also design their own lives so they walk through the world without having much interruption or interacting with police at all, aside from community events and speeding tickets, right? And so when you think about that, police are just sitting in black and brown neighborhoods waiting for something to happen, and it doesn't happen that way, and that is a privilege that they have.
Absolutely.
So we know that white privilege is a thing, right? Like, it's real, and it's something that we all agree on. How have you navigated the circumstances where this is evident?
Yeah, we have a lot of conversations around who in our relationship might be best to have certain conversations or to advocate for a bill being lowered, like, right, the cable bill or something, which most of the time is over the phone. But what would that look like? Or we've talked through even getting our, it seems like small things, but they're real, where we want to get our car repaired. And I typically will be able to take it in and get some favorable treatment and sometimes even free services in a way that, you know, Michael goes, how did you swing that again? I said, I didn't do anything. I just showed up and told him what was wrong, right? I wasn't.
So even just like, I mean, we have this, we're trying to get a tree out of our backyard of our neighbors, and she's an elderly lady. And just for us, the idea is when we need to, because we, in the idea, I need to interact with the neighbor. If I don't know them, and I assume they are white, which I know they're white, I will ask Autumn to go talk to them. Because I sit on our HOA board, and the amount of times as a board member that I have been putting a yard of the month sign in someone's yard or giving someone an award But the moment I come up to their porch or their door and it swings open and it's, who are you? Right? Like the idea that I can't even add to the safety of my neighborhood without being seen as a threat.
Wow. Mm. And additionally, so Michael and I spent about a year and a half apart. When I was in New Orleans, he was in Tulsa when he took his role with Teach for America. That opened my eyes a lot to white privilege because I had relationships and friendships that started without them knowing who I was married to in a way that people always knew of both Michael and I in our social circles in Dallas. Yeah. And the conversations I was exposed to that way, right? Because it wasn't even at work. It was in personal life. You know, people are doing what they're doing, having those conversations behind closed doors, if you will. And things just come up. And I call them the you know conversations. They don't say anything necessarily overtly. Sometimes so, but most of the time it's not. It's the, you know what I mean, you know, those people, or, you know, well, they won't really know, or they don't really, or we don't really care about them. And I found myself flabbergasted because it came in so many different forms. You know, you prepare yourself to identify how to address it in one conversation, and then it seems to morph into a different way. And every time I ended up asking people, who are they, or what are we actually talking about, it diluted into most of the time not even a point. Yet they were using it as leverage to make themselves feel better or more empowered. And I've even seen that in my own family. In my extended family, there was a member of my family that ended up dating someone who was a person of color. And their ex ended up saying some really hurtful racial things in ways that I've never heard that person say. And they only said it when they felt like they had to defend their own piety or where their stance. And that's where I think that's where character comes out, right? It's when you believe this could be a tool to your own benefit, even though you say it's wrong, but you'll use it because you know that just like we saw with Amy Cooper, right? You know that you can use it as a weapon if you need to. And I find that to be one of the more troubling things about white privilege is we can all say, well, why don't we all just get along and be nice to each other? But when people feel that their status is threatened, even if it's not equal status, but their level of privilege or I'm going on and on about this, but I find it so troubling when at the end of the day, if people are willing to weaponize their own privilege, they've got some work to do.
What suggestions do you have for white people regarding all of the things that we've talked about and how you've navigated your identities in this space, in this time? What can you offer, or what would you suggest that white people need to hear?
Is this one for Autumn or for either of us?
For either of you.
I'll start with that. I'll let you do the conclusion on that, Michael. I would say my encouragement to myself and to other white people is to really dive in and ask the hard questions. There are plenty of resources, and there will be more coming in future years, I'm sure of it, but there are so many resources at our fingertips to better understand identity, racism, privilege. And when we can conveniently say things like, I don't get involved in politics, or we don't talk about religion or politics or any of that in our family. And while I realize that that those are tricky things, I think it's because many of us don't have the tools to engage in productive and respectful conversation when we might not agree on something. Because then if we can't do that, then we can't learn, then we can't change. And I know in the way I was brought up, there's so much emphasis on being right, and there's so much fear of being wrong or saying, hey, I now have more information. I now have changed my mind on this, or I now see how my actions, despite my good intent, really had an impact that was negative. We don't have that language, and so I think we are indignantly avoidant of that to just prove our point right. Mm-hmm. And so, to summarize that, just doing reading, asking the hard questions, and yes, engaging in conversation. But it's not about asking your black friend who you're on the same sports team with to identify that for you. If you've done some self-work, then you can, I know many people would gladly engage in those conversations, but you've got to care more about your own growth than others.
Right.
Yeah. That's good. Mikhail, we're coming to you with it as well. And this is like these conversations are based upon like hopefully learned experiences that you both have from interacting with each other, right? Because I'm gonna be honest, I don't have the benefit of interacting with white people in the personal way that you do, you know? I would, you know, so like based upon that, like what would you say, what suggestions do you have for black people to maybe be able to have those difficult conversations and like help us get towards changing this thing?
Yeah. I mean, at least for us, I mean, I don't know if every interracial relationship has this talk at some point. I think everyone should, but it's getting clear about how I will ask questions. So like a personal example of what that was the first time Adam and I had to set that boundary. And it's in the past what happened, but it's something we grew from. I had invited a large number of like family members over for our new house. And she wasn't living here yet, but she was almost living here. But it was our house, we bought it, new couch, like we were excited. And we had friends over already for like a housewarming party, but these are our college friends, our friends that are other young professionals. So some people of color, but it was much more of a mixed, much more affluent, middle-class group of people. The next weekend or something like that, I had my mom over, lots of my siblings and stuff. And I, during that time, like Autumn was much more worried about like, hey, well, they need to change the baby. Should they go on the couch? Or what's the rule if they need to drink something? Where do they drink it at? And in the moment, like we talked, right, she is worried about how do we keep the couch clean, right? She's worried about how do we not get that thing too sticky. But then as people leave and I have to be honest and say, hey, babe, that felt weird. And she's like, well, what do you mean? It felt weird that when we had 20 of our friends over, we didn't think about who could drink where. We didn't think about who could sit where and what they could do where. But when we had my family over, that was a concern. And to say that to your partner, the person you should love and care about the most, and they have to be able to listen to that, right? So it takes her being like, oh, dang. Like, I didn't see it like that. And that is what happened. So how do we talk about that? What do we need to do so that those situations don't happen again, right? But we have to be able to talk about it. I refuse to be silenced by white people who say they love me as an individual. If you care about me, then I'm going to talk about these things. And you can listen, or you cannot be in spaces where this is going to come up for me. And that's been hard because there's people that I loved and cared about a lot in college that were at our wedding that I no longer have a relationship with. It's not a politics thing. I thought you saw my humanity, and I realized you see me as some exception. You don't see me as who I am. And we had years of things built on a lie. So I think that's one thing for white people. Like, you have to get comfortable with people calling you out or calling you in and really listening to them and then being okay with that. I don't hate my wife anymore, right? I'm not like she's the worst person in the world, but because she is white, she will always have blinders to the black experience. Just like because I am cisgender male, I will always have blinders to her being a woman. But you have to want to talk about it.
Yeah, no, that's real. I think about this. When we were in Dallas, Becky, Sean, and I, we were hanging out, and Sean said something so profound to me. He said, the same systems that create my white privilege make it difficult for me to see it. And I've always gone back to that comment because he was like, tell me when I do something because I just may not know. Right? Like, and so but having been in relationship with people is what allows you to have those conversations. And it just makes me think about, like, how much more intentional I want to be. I already have a pretty diverse friend set. I think my wife has a pretty diverse friend set as well. But, like, how intentional we can be about being in relationship with people and setting it up so that we can have those conversations.
Yeah. And it's also like if you have the capacity to, right? Like I think I know that that's something I try to model for, at least I do, I say that to my white friends. I am someone who does equity work for a living. So I will engage with you and answer these questions because I choose to. But it is not because you're my friend and I'm black, I'm obligated to help you process through these things. And making sure people get that clear difference. Like, I don't want lots of white people like, let me go get black friends so I can start asking them questions, right? Like, no, right, it's not right, that, right. You know? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. As we wrap up this conversation, I would really love to hear, on a positive note, what makes your relationship work? Hello?
We're both looking at each other. Who's going to go?
All right. That can be a tough question, too, you know, in spite of everything, in spite of everything that's going on, the differences that you have, you choose love, in spite of, like, the different, you know, all these different discrepancies. So what makes it work? What is
it? I'll say that I'm a better person because of Michael. He's the first person that I've been with romantically that has seen me and my ambitions and my dreams as a woman, and I've not felt like he's ever put me in my place. And he also holds me accountable to things I say that I care about, to causes and the way I want to treat people and what I say is important. And, I mean, we still struggle with that, right? I mean, throughout our whole lives, we will, but he doesn't let up on making me a better helping me be a better person. Rather, he has the hard conversations. That's one thing I'm so thankful for with us. We might bicker frequently, but it's because we talk about it. We talk and talk and talk. We get it out. We get angry with each other. We get sad. We'll cry. We'll engage. But it's because we care so much about each other growing.
Yeah.
And really. Understanding that. And so that's what I'm thankful for Michael, is that I've always seen that he sees me as a very highly capable person, regardless of my gender, because that's the one thing that is sometimes a very sensitive thing for me when people treat me differently based on that. And it's usually they're blind to it, right? And but at the same time, he also helps me see how I can continue to improve and treat him with dignity as a person, regardless of his demographics. At the same time, seeing him as a black man and knowing that he has a specific experience with the world and with others, to be always seen and not ignored.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. I think what makes us work is we are aware of our choice. I mean, I say aware of our choices. We believe love is a choice. We have chosen to love each other. And how I always say that is, you can't choose your family, but marriage is you get to pick one person in the whole world and be like, hey, dog, we can. Like, we going to be here forever. And I chose Autumn. And so because of that, nothing will ever, like, stop me from making sure that we are trying to be as best together as possible, because our belief is we get one shot. So you, my person. Mm-hmm. And so we will make this work. So being, like, really aware of the choices we make, choosing to love each other, choosing to communicate when it's hard, choosing to pause when we need to because we're at capacity, right? Just those choices. And then I also just think, like, oh, Joy, my wife's really goofy. I know that's, like, not the nice thing, but she's just goofy. And I'm goofy. I'm weird, too. So it kind of works in that way where, you know, it's just two of us, no kids yet, and our house is always loud. Because we are always doing something.
Yeah, I really appreciate that reflection. And I think this time has definitely brought my husband and I together in a way that I never could have imagined. I see him out on the front line. I see him going live. And while I'm afraid and scared every time he leaves, I'm so grateful for his passion. I'm so grateful for his consistency. And the honest conversations that we have when he comes back home, like, tell me about it. And he challenges me to think in so many different ways about our politics and our political landscape that I was like, ugh, who cares about that? But now I care, and now I get it, and now I want to be engaged, and I want to ask more questions, and I want to have conversations about it. And so I really, really appreciated this conversation with you two and being brought into this space, because it's so important, and it's so relevant to us right now. So really appreciate this time with you all, and I'm going to pass it back to you.
Thank you.
I mean, I think she said everything that I could have said, even better. Thank you for joining us on the Black Work Experience podcast. This podcast, as I said earlier, has been a little bit different because we really wanted to reflect upon those same conversations about microaggressions and race and identity, but use the lens of police brutality and what's happening in our country to reflect upon them. So thank you for the honest conversation. Thank you for the introspection, and thank you for being a part of and doing this work along with us.
Hey, no problem. We appreciate y'all for thinking of us and lifting us up, and we will continue to send y'all and your family all the positivity and love that we can. So appreciate it.
Absolutely. Goodbye. Talk to you later.
Thank you for listening to the Black Work Experience podcast. None of this is possible without your help. Make sure you all follow us on Twitter at BWE Podcast and on IG at BWE Pod. If you want to send us a submission for mail time, feel free to email us at blackworkexperiencepod@gmail.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
Domino, only spot a few blacks behind you. Domino, only spot a few blacks behind you.